Thanks, Christine. Good morning, everyone. Thanks for spending some time with us. I'll spend sort of a minute or two at the start just introducing Michael. I know you haven't come here to hear from me, so I'll hand over to the investment expert. Just a little bit of background. There's a few brands, obviously, in the mix with the broader NAB group. JANA is our institutional asset consulting business, and it's the largest institutional asset consultant in Australia. If you're a large sort of industry super fund or a corporate or a charity, that sort of thing, JANA is sort of the go-to person if you're trying to access the pools of money that sit in the institutional space. So in the institutional land, JANA have a team of sort of 40, 45 investment professionals who travel the world looking for managers, putting asset allocations together, and then presenting them back to the institutional clients. What we've done at NAB Invest, which is the direct asset management part of the group, is looked at some of the offerings within JANA and thought there's a few things there that we'd like to offer to select segments of the retail market, the more high-end segments of the market that we think could understand some of the things that we offer in the institutional space. And the one that we want to talk about specifically is the JANA Triple Point Fund that Michael O'Day runs, who's standing on my left. So Michael is the head of hedge fund research at JANA. Michael's been a member of the JANA team for about 7 years now. JANA as a business runs about $120 billion for institutional clients. So in that institutional space, really, really big players, probably not that much of a brand name in the retail space, but again, we're sort of selectively picking out segments of that retail market to take some of these institutional offerings to. So Michael's a techo or a propeller head, as I'd describe him. He's right into this sort of stuff. Michael gets excited about thinking around ways to better structure hedge funds and offer better sort of facilities to clients. And one of the challenges that Michael's had, I suppose, back in 2006, he was looking at ways to better offer hedge fund type facilities to some of the institutional clients that JANA deal with, and the traditionally fairly conservative clients in most cases, some of the big industry funds and some of the corporates. And the issues that Michael was coming across constantly were things like, you know, the incredible opaqueness of the structures that were wrapped around hedge funds, so the lack of transparency, the relatively high fee structures, and the lack of liquidity. Liquidity has obviously been a killer in this segment. Investors that have piled into other forms of hedge funds have obviously been hurt by that. Many people in the room would have exposures there that you've been hurt by. So Michael was sort of tossing around those three issues. He was given a brief by Ian Patrick, who's the head of JANA, CEO at JANA, to go away and come up with something that you think will address those issues. The good news is Michael's done that, presented it to the institutional clients a couple of years ago. They've backed it. The fund's now got about $350 million in it, and we're pleased to be able to offer that to the retail market. So without any further ado, I'll hand over to Michael to take us through some more detail on the challenge that he had and how he's addressed it.
Thank you, Peter. Can everyone hear me? Is that working? Okay. It's an interesting topic because it presupposes that you actually want to make an investment in hedge funds. And after 2008, a number of our clients, as I'm sure a number of your clients, really questioned the investment proposition of hedge funds. So before I talk specifically about the topic, I wanted to talk about why invest in hedge funds in the first place. Then I wanted to talk about the current structures and drill down a little bit further in terms of understanding what drives hedge fund returns. Then talk about different ways in which you can structure these investments so you can overcome those issues of transparency, control and liquidity. It was interesting to hear Bill Gross this morning talk about the new normal and what that means. So I won't spend too much time on this slide, but since 1981, there was a period of time up until the end of 2007, which some people refer to as the long boom. Since the subprime crisis and the deleveraging has started to take hold, we may now be in a period which could be called the long goodbye. And we might have to get used to accepting lower asset price returns from a range of different investments. But what does that mean for people who are trying to save for retirement? Well, it might mean that they have to work longer and delay their retirement. It might also mean that they have to consume less and save more. And the third thing it means is that they'll have to invest more wisely. And I think the need for quality investment advice is probably greater now than it's ever been in the past. And it's on that latter point which really ties into hedge funds. hedge funds offer different ways in which to construct portfolios, and if harnessed correctly, they actually have a pretty powerful role to play in portfolios. So what are hedge funds? Well, hedge funds are really a collection of different investment techniques which are applied to traditional asset classes. So they invest in bonds and equities, but it's the way in which they invest which distinguishes them. They use techniques such as short selling, making money when markets go down or securities go down. They use derivatives and they use leverage. And the green line at the top shows hedge fund performance since 1991. And hedge fund performance has been quite outstanding, even including 2008. Annualised returns are 12.4% for about 7% annualised risk. The next best performing asset class is Australian equities, and that's the light blue line. Australian equities have delivered 10.4% at almost double the risk of hedge funds at 14%. And everything else is more or less left behind, including the combination of different asset classes which you'd find in a balanced fund. There's only been one occasion when hedge funds have fallen as much as the equity markets, and that was in August of 1998, and that was when Russia actually defaulted on their sovereign bonds, and it coincided with the hedge fund blow-up of LTCM. Hedge funds fell about 8% during that time. And last year, hedge funds fell about half as much as the equity markets. What's interesting about last year was you couldn't have picked a much worse time for hedge funds. They had plummeting equity markets, they had investment banks which were collapsing, and they had government intervention which banned the sale of short selling in some areas. So out of all of that, we felt that the 2008 actually justified or demonstrated the robust nature of hedge fund investment strategies. But investors were disappointed nonetheless, and I think a lot of the disappointment actually came from their expectations versus the reality of what hedge funds actually are. People expected hedge funds to deliver cash plus five. After all, that was their historical investment performance. But there is no investment that you can invest in that delivers cash plus five year in, year out. It's just not possible. The other expectation was that hedge funds would have low correlations to traditional asset classes like equities. Well, traditional hedge funds actually did demonstrate low correlations. They just weren't negatively correlated. They weren't making money when other markets were going down. But anything that had a beta of about 0.4 to the equity markets last year would have been down about 20%. The third expectation is that volatility is a good measure of risk, and diversified portfolios of hedge funds were touting that they would have volatility of about 4% on an annualised basis. With an investment with 4% risk, you shouldn't have, or you know, statistically it should be difficult to actually achieve a minus 20% result. But volatility is not a good measure of risk if you're not marking to market every position in your portfolio. And you can take the example of a homeowner who buys a house and then sits on that house until they decide to sell it and move somewhere else. If they were to actually auction that property off on a day-to-day basis, they would get a good idea of what the market clearing rate for that property was, and they'd see the true inherent volatility of owning that property. And hedge funds were the same, and fund of funds use many techniques to invest in less liquid areas of the market to artificially lower their volatility. The fourth area was that hedge funds are as defensive as bonds and should be funded from a bond allocation. Hedge funds have never been as defensive as bonds and won't be in the future. But where current bond yields are at the moment at about 3.5%, we believe that hedge funds have a greater potential to outperform bonds. The current investment environment is actually quite compelling for hedge funds for a number of reasons. I've got two examples here, and the first example is stock correlations. This looks at individual stock correlations of the US market, and they're currently at a three-decade high. They're even higher than during 1987, which was obviously a panic period of panic selling. So last year you had panic selling, and it didn't matter whether or not the company was good or bad. The company was sold down as people were flying into cash. And this year you've seen a panic rally, people wanting to keep up with the market and buying stocks, and so prices have been moving together. We don't believe that those correlations are going to stay at that level. We think that they'll come down to more historical normal level. And under that environment, good companies will continue to prosper and survive and gain in market share, while the bad companies that are highly levered will actually go out of business. And that is a perfect environment for active managers, and it's a perfect environment for long-short equity managers who can profit by selling short the companies that are going bankrupt. But the other reason that hedge funds, this environment suit hedge funds, is that there are certain securities which are largely ignored by long-only investors. And I use the example of a convertible bond. Now, a convertible bond is a bond with a call option on an equity attached to it. And it doesn't fit into a bond portfolio, and it doesn't really fit into an equity portfolio. So it's largely ignored by mainstream investors. Currently, if you value the bond and you value the call option on the equity, convertible bonds are trading at about a 9 to 10% discount on the sum of its parts. And a hedge fund manager can buy the convertible bond, short sell the equity, so they remove and hedge out the equity exposure, and they can also short the credit, so they can remove the credit exposure and try and lock in that discounted value. And provided that governments don't ban the short selling, they should be able to lock in those returns. But there are hurdles to hedge fund investing, and they're not the panacea. And you know, there were three critical questions which we wanted to address in the research that we do at JANA. The first question is, how do I make sure that I'm getting value for money? Hedge funds are notoriously expensive, and sometimes it's worth paying those fees, but sometimes it's not worth paying those fees. To take an example, a long-short equity manager that has a 60% net exposure to the market, if the market was up 10%, you would expect that long-short equity manager to be up 6% at a minimum. But they typically charge 20% performance fees for any performance over zero. So they're earning 1.2% in additional fees for something that you can replicate by investing 60% into stocks and 40% into cash. So that's one issue, one area which really needs to be tackled in the hedge fund industry. The second area is hedge funds are a black box. I don't understand them. I don't know what they do. And there's situations in some circumstances of outright fraud. How do I get the transparency so I can protect my investors' interests? And the third area is that last year, funds suspended redemptions. Other funds lost their FX hedges. How do I make sure that I've got control of the asset so that I can pay my counterparty if I've got an FX margin call, or I can meet the redemption requests of my investors? These are the three critical issues which a lot of research was spent on, and I'll take you through them one by one. First of all, to ensure that you've got appropriate fee structures, you need to actually understand what drives hedge fund returns. So we started with going back to basics. There are four primary drivers of returns of any investment, whether you look at equities, bonds, or whether you look at real estate, and hedge funds is no different. They're just a combination, a different mix of these four drivers of returns. The first driver of return is traditional market exposures. This is where you buy a financial claim on an earnings stream in anticipation that that earnings stream is going to increase. And what affects the increase or decrease of that earnings stream are things like GDP growth, credit expansion or contraction cycles, and the level of monetary policy within a country. The second driver of return is really manager skill. Momentary mispricings of securities or markets and being able to identify whether they're cheap or expensive and building a better portfolio than that of the market. And a classic example of a good investor is Warren Buffett. He would fit between the first and the second primary driver of return. Then the third area is liquidity risk. Investors have a preference to have their money at hand rather than locking it up for long periods of time. If they go into a bank, they would expect that if they're going into a term deposit, that they'd be paid a higher interest rate than if it was an at-call account. That's called a liquidity risk premium. And the fourth area is an interesting area. We call it underwriting risk, and this is where risk is being transferred in the financial market from one player to another player. And in some instances, long-only equity portfolios would like to buy put options on the market if their view of the market is that it's quite risky and it might there might be a drop in the valuation of the markets. Somebody has to actually write that put option, and in return for writing that put option, underwriting the risk that the manager wants to protect, they earn a premium. And like an insurance company, they're underwriting a catastrophic event for a small premium. If you're going to do that well, you want to be well diversified. You just don't want one type of risk. And hedge funds are classic at being able to do this. But it's not manager skill. They're still underwriting risk in the marketplace with the investor's money, not their own money, the investor's money, and they're charging a performance fee for the privilege of underwriting that risk. Sometimes it works, and if they're a well-run hedge fund, then they'll do it well. If they're not a well-run hedge fund, they'll do it poorly, similar to that of an insurance company. So together, diversified portfolios of hedge funds, our research has shown that it's broadly mixed or diversified across the four primary sources of returns. In contrast, a balanced fund is heavily exposed to equity markets and traditional market exposure, some manager skill and some illiquidity risk. To take an example of a traditional investment fund, if this was an Australian long-only manager who invests in the S&P ASX 300, 90%+ of their returns would be explained by the return of the ASX 300. And then the residual return is due to their manager's skill, and that could be positive or negative. A hedge fund typically claims that everything that they do is manager skill, hence the fee structure of 20% above zero. Even if their money is largely their collateral sitting in cash and they're earning 20% of what the interest rate on the cash is. If you drill down a little bit further, you find that actually some of their return is coming from traditional market exposure. They might be a long short equity manager that has a residual long bias to equity markets. And then when you apply a magnifying glass to their alpha, some of their exposures are common hedge fund exposures where they're underwriting risk in the market or they're using rules-based trading systems which are common across hedge fund managers. And the residual return is due to their manager's skill. But their skill is actually a lot less than what they originally proclaim it to be. And to put that to the test, we looked at a number of studies, and this was one study conducted by Lars Jaeger, and he looked at the 10-year return from the HFRI fund-weighted composite. That's the universe of hedge funds that report to the HFRI. And the returns were about 6% for 7% vol. Now, to measure that, what he wanted to do was construct an index of three things. One was just the Credit Suisse High Yield Index, just representing the traditional market exposures. And the other two things were alternative betas, or things where it was a transfer of risk in the market. One factor was a simple trend-following model, and it's quoted on Bloomberg as the SGFI. And the second was the BXN, which is you buy the S&P 500 and you write call options over the top of the S&P 500. The interesting thing was it matched quite closely to the overall hedge fund returns. Similar amounts of return for similar amounts of risk. There's obviously some deviations, and people could argue that this is data mining, but it raised a lot of questions as to whether or not manager skill was present in the overall hedge fund index or whether they were picking up other risk premiums in the market. So let's look at long-short equities, because the same story can be seen here. This is the Credit Suisse Tremont Long Short Equity Index and its performance over time, and it's outperformed the equity markets for half the risk by about 3%. But this is the BXM index. This is just the buy the S&P 500 right call options over the top, and it matches quite closely. So the aggregate of those managers, perhaps they don't have as much skill as each of them individually thinks that they do. Drilling down a bit further, there's where there's a merger situation, Company A is taking over Company X. Company A obviously has to offer a premium to the market price of Company X. And in this case, they're offering a premium of $25 per share. Now, Company X's share price might jump from $20 to $23. But it doesn't automatically go up to the bid price of $25 if there's some uncertainty around why that deal would go through. And the uncertainty could be because of regulatory reasons or because Company A's due diligence on Company X uncovers something that they don't like. A merger arbitrage manager would go in at this point and they would buy Company X's shares and they would sell short Company A's shares to try and isolate the market movements. What they're trying to do is capture the deal spread of $2. And if it goes through, they'll make $2 on their investment, so about a 9% return. Now, a merger arbitrage manager will say that they are better than the market at being able to predict the probabilities of this deal going through or not. If you invest in a fund of fund, they will have 10 or maybe 15 merger arbitrage managers. I don't believe that you can pick 10 or 15 managers who are equally as good at getting the deals right. And together, you're paying them all 2% base fees and 20% of performance above zero. So some will get it right, and they'll be paid their performance fees. Some will get it wrong. They'll still pick up their 2% base fees. Overall, your result's probably an average result around the merger arbitrage index, but your MER has increased. If the probability of a successful deal is already factored into the stock price of the company, why not just invest in every deal and don't pay anyone a performance fee? And it's interesting because the market is very, very good at being able to predict whether a deal is going to go through or not. That chart shows that for the higher spreads, higher average spreads indicate that the deal has failed. And the lower spreads, the deals have actually gone through. And in 2001, Mitchell and Pulvino studied 4,750 merger transactions. They invested in all of them by going long the target company and short the acquirer, and they got returns of 10.6% for about 7% risk, which was very, very close to the merger arbitrage hedge fund index overall. So what does this mean for portfolio construction? Well, you can use that framework for building portfolios. Start by recognising where the market exposure is and don't pay performance fees for it. You can implement that through futures or ETFs or, you know, a simple fund, but it doesn't have to incur performance fees and it should incur only a low base fee because there is very little skill in doing that. Then there are these hedge fund, commonly replicated hedge fund techniques like the merger arbitrage example. If you're attracted to the merger premium, access it by investing in all the deals. It's a little bit more complicated than just getting the traditional market exposure, but you can do it, and again, you don't need to pay performance fees. And then there's manager skill. If you can identify managers who can pick stocks better than the market or time the market better, they are worth paying $2.20 for. But there's another advantage of actually understanding alternative beta or common hedge fund techniques, and that is, this is a manager, a managed future manager who came into Jana's office and they returned 12% returns for 17% risk and they were charging 2% base fees and 20% above zero. We said under no circumstance do we think that everything above zero is due to their manager skill. In fact, if you look at the SGFI index, which is a simple trend following index, you can see that there is some alpha, but it's not above zero. It's actually above this line. And if we're going to engage in further discussions, we would insist on structuring a performance fee above an index like this, a more suitable benchmark for them. And so if we were to pay them 20% of performance above the benchmark, it would have resulted in this line. Now that is a 1.7% per annum increase in net of fee returns. Or if you're invested $100, $45 over that time period, which I think is about 10 years. That's a huge pickup just by getting the right performance fee structures. And overall, if you use that framework, you can cut down the cost of investing in a diversified portfolio of hedge funds by 50%. It's a 2 to 4% overall pickup in returns. It's worth doing, and it's worth understanding what drives these returns. But it's not only about fees, it's also about the other issues of transparency, control, and liquidity. There are many risks of investing in hedge funds, And every investor has to make up their own mind of whether or not those risks are worth taking. But the only way that you can effectively manage those risks is if you build up a picture of the total risk of the portfolio from the position level holdings. But the common approach is where a fund to fund receives investments from investors like you or investors like your clients, and then they make applications into a hedge fund vehicle which is located over in the Cayman Islands. At that point, they receive shares or units in that trust. They lose all control over the investment, and they have only the transparency which the manager is willing to provide to them. If they do happen to conduct reasonable due diligence and they uncover a problem or a couple of problems, then they will have to lodge a redemption request, and it might be processed over several months. And at that point, pretty much anything can happen, right? It's going to take a while to get your money back. The alternative solution is for the fund-to-fund manager to only appoint the hedge fund manager as a trading advisor, a sub-advisor to the fund, and that all the legal relationships are held by the fund-to-fund. They appoint the custodian or the prime broker in the hedge fund case, and that way they get full position level transparency, they maintain full control over the accounts, and if there's something that they don't like, they can terminate the investment manager at a moment's notice. And because they've got position level holdings data, they can enhance their risk management as well. For me, there are four very simple principles to follow. One, and it kind of follows common sense, but Voltaire said the common sense is not necessarily common, and it hasn't been common in the industry. But one, maintain control of your assets. Demand position level transparency from an independent source. Don't trust the fund manager to provide that to you. Three, ensure the liquidity which is being offered to investors is the same liquidity which you can get from selling the securities. Fund to funds last year had a huge mismatch in what they were offering investors, either monthly or quarterly, and the terms of which they were agreeing to invest in, which could have been 2 or 3 year lockups. And if you look at the liquidity profile of some of the fund to funds, it could take up to 4 or plus years to get out of all those positions. That was not an appropriate structure to be investing in. And pay fees that are reasonable and appropriate and commensurate with the manager's skill. So overall, in summary, it's not only about the historical risk and return characteristics of hedge funds that makes a compelling case for hedge fund investing. It's actually the return opportunities today, and there are a huge amount of dislocations in the market which are very attractive for hedge funds to exploit. But it's important to harness hedge funds properly, and by that you need to ensure that there's fairer fee structures, better liquidity and better transparency into the underlying portfolio. And on that, I'm sure that you've got a number of questions, but I think I have to hand back to Pete. But I'm happy to take your questions after that.
Great. Thanks, Michael. Just wrapping that up quickly, guys, before we hand over to David in the question session. Effectively, what we've done is obviously looked at all those issues that Michael pointed out, Michael had a brief at JANA to come up with something to address that. And as a result of that, we put a fund together called the JANA Triple Point Fund. So the Triple Point Fund is a hedge fund that that addresses those three key pillars that we think need to be addressed, and they're three key pillars that have caught a lot of people out in the past. That's around getting fees at acceptable levels, getting complete transparency, so a complete look through to what the underlying investments are, and also getting liquidity. So mark-to-market daily, full liquidity for clients to meet redemptions. And that's obviously been the issue in the past with some of the retail hedge funds. The reason why we think it's a good time now to launch this into the market is we've been running this in the institutional markets for JANA, for their institutional clients. It's ticked all the boxes with those guys, and we think it's a good time now to position the fund in the retail market. I suppose the view we've got is that obviously a lot of people have been burnt by these things. We look at some of the money that's currently frozen in this sort of sector and think when it becomes available, and some of it's becoming available in tranches now, we sort of have a view that half of it will sort of run for the hills, and investors will say, I'm never going near this sort of stuff again. But we still think a lot of advisors and clients on the advice of advisors, will see that there is still room for an exposure like this in a portfolio, as long as they can see what they're investing in, the fees are okay, and they can get money out whenever they want to. And on that basis, we've put the fund together. So the objective of the fund is to achieve cash plus 5% with 6% volatility over rolling four-year periods. That's been through all the testing that Michael and his research team at JANA have done. We think that's absolutely achievable. Funds under management, we've talked through the philosophy. Funds under management, we seeded with 152 mil in 07. Ongoing applications, and that's been in the institutional market, have taken the fund to 343, and we've just launched the fund in the retail market. So the fund in the retail market, access-wise, will be available on, it goes on the MasterKey Custom Wrap on the 1st of September, and in the next 6 to 8 weeks, it'll be going on to BT Wrap, Macquarie Wrap, and Navigator are the other ones, and First Wrap, Peter Chun down the back's there going to look after us, hopefully, with First Wrap. So that's how we sort of see the retail distribution going. From a ratings point of view, the fund received a recommended from Lonsec first up, first rating, which we think was something we're pretty proud of. And we're talking to Zenith and S&P as the other two key houses we want to look and obtain ratings from, and Van Eyck would be the others we talk to down the track as well. So that's sort of the access points. Final piece there on just how we've then cut the fund up to address the issues that Michael pointed out. The fund effectively invests down into three buckets, if you like, and it's completely in line with the three areas that Michael pointed out that you can sort of cut up the attribution based on. So we've got efficient beta, so there's a 40% exposure to efficient beta, which is, to Michael's point, saying, look, if a manager's going to just deliver beta returns, don't pay performance fees on that sort of stuff. Get that for as cheap as you possibly can, and that's what we're doing in that section. Allocated 40% there. The team at JANA have the ability to weight that, sort of overweight or underweight that 40%, and Michael and the JANA asset allocation team meet to review what that holding needs to be. Alternative beta is the other exposure that that we have, and that's allocated at 20%. The alternative beta exposure, again, is more the sort of long-short variable beta type investing. But again, in that space, if there's a variable beta manager and his net exposure is 60%, we want to be paying performance fees on true manager skill, if you like. So we're not going to be paying performance fees purely because they're dialing up and down the beta exposure. So again, it's drilling right down into the way these guys are doing it. And I suppose the beauty of JANA being the ones that are negotiating these things with the underlying managers is because JANA is such a big player in the institutional market, we're leveraging that in retail, we can have a hedge fund manager come in and propose crazy fees, and we've sort of got the scale to be able to say, look, if you want to be part of this proposition, we're not prepared to do it at that level. We would only look to add you into a portfolio, obviously, if you get all the investment ticks, but from a fee point of view, the fees need to look like this. And then on the alpha side, that's pure manager skill. We are prepared to pay underlying managers performance fees there if they are legitimately generating true alpha. We'll pay them appropriately. So that's how we've set that up. The net result is the end cost of the client is lower in that we're paying those underlying managers based on exactly what they're doing. We're not paying for guys that are just giving us beta return, and we're only paying excess for performance fees of the guys that are generating the excess return. The net result to the client is an increase in total return, because obviously that's where that comes from. And finally, on the performance, we talked a little bit about this earlier, but the fund has been going since January 08. Over that period, the fund's represented by the green line at the top. You can see that the performance in a relative sense has been good. We've got other charts like this that includes those three indices, but also things like the S&P ASX 200 and 300, the Mercer Balance Fund Index. And in all cases, that green line at the top, which is the triple point exposure or the triple point fund, has far exceeded that with much lower levels of volatility. So the volatility relative to all those other comparisons has been much lower. And importantly, I suppose, the thing that Michael and the team are very proud of is that throughout October last year, when the world was sort of falling apart in a financial sense and there was real liquidity issues, the FX hedge was maintained completely, maintained full daily liquidity and pricing. There was no fraud issues, no exposure to Bear Stearns or Lehman's. and no suspension of redemptions, which is obviously something the team are proud of. And I suppose it goes to show that the way we've set the thing up using the SMA structure and the ownership structures being different, that's all great in theory and it's great on PowerPoint slides, but at the end of the day, if it doesn't play out in reality, it's not worth a lot. So it's we're pretty proud that it stood up strongly throughout that period. So that's the end of the information I wanted to run through. That's the JANA disclaimer, which I'm sure you'll have a read through. But with that, I might hand back to Christina. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Peter. Before I hand over to David, I just wanted to bring your attention to the fact that each of our due diligence partners is asked to prepare a research paper, and Michael has prepared one as well. These research papers on the subject are available on our website, on the Portfolio Construction Forum website, following the conference. And I might now hand over to David to do his key takeouts.
Thanks, Christina. Yeah, I guess in our dealings with dealer groups and advisors, one of the things that we've noticed pretty strongly actually as a result of the global financial crisis is a pullback from using alternatives and very much a back-to-basics approach, which is unfortunate because you could argue, and we do argue, that the inclusion of alternatives in portfolios, you really need to be bringing them in because they provide greater diversity, low correlation with the existing mainstream asset classes, and greater insurance, which is what some of the speakers talked about yesterday, Pippa Melgram and Dr. Doom. Hedge funds have been one of the ones that have been most affected by that, and you can sort of understand that, and a lot of the points that Michael touched on there are the reasons for that. So lack of transparency, in fact they were probably sold poorly to start with. Way back when we started to have hedge funds introduced to the retail market, the catch cry was equity-like returns with bond-like volatility. In hindsight, that was never going to happen. And in fact, what we've often seen delivered is really bond-like returns with even lower volatility, bordering on close to sort of cash-like. So I think people have been disappointed by the return profile of fund-to-fund hedge funds when, in reality, they probably actually delivered what they were supposed to. Having said that, there's been other issues like structure. In Australia, with the foreign investment fund regulation and the feeder fund structure of most of the fund-to-fund hedge funds, it has meant that there's a bed and breakfast requirement around sort of June 30, which as an investor means that you're getting virtually all of your return back to you by way of income. Again, that probably wasn't expected by the retail market. We sort of used hedge funds in high net worth portfolios, larger portfolios, that usually probably the investor didn't require the income. So unless you were structured correctly or was in a sort of low tax paying environment like a self-managed super fund, a lot of that return was sort of chewed up by way of tax. Having said all that, we've at Zenith do a bit of work with the Alternative Investment Managers Association, which as the name suggests is AIMA, which is a collective of a lot of the hedge fund managers in the Australian market. You go along to sort of their drink sessions and whatever, and you meet a lot of hedge fund managers that we in Australia, particularly in the retail market, have never ever heard of, and yet they're managing $200, $300, up to $1 billion. You ask them where their funds under management's come from, and it's all from overseas investors, or predominantly from overseas investors. So what that tells you is there is actually there is an appetite and demand for hedge funds by overseas and institutional investors, which often leads, as you know, what happens in the retail market. So it's been unfortunate because we've had a couple of managers, I guess, pull back from the fund-to-fund hedge fund space due to sort of lack of support. I mean, it's great to see actually that JANA have done the opposite, sort of built up the economies of scale through the institutional business and then bringing that to the retail market and addressing some of those structural and transparency issues. So as I said at the start, we do think there's a place for hedge funds. It's been proven, as I say, by international and institutional investors. and we think they'll play an important role in portfolios and portfolio construction going forward. So I think we've got some time now for questions to Michael or Peter.
Let me just give you the mic because the session's been recorded.
Sorry, Paul, just a quick question. How do you therefore manage the FX side given the experience of the last 18 months and the casualties that have come from FX management?
Yep. It's really important that you actually have liquidity at the underlying portfolio. So the bulk of what we invest in is actually exchange-traded futures, ETFs, things of that nature, which you don't have the counterparty risk which you have in an OTC contract, for example, and you can actually get a market clearing price when you sell the security. Our FX hedge was put to the test last year. The Aussie dollar was at 97 cents, and over the period of 3 months, it fell to 62 cents. And 3 weeks before the Aussie sort of hit its low, Lehman Brothers, as an investment bank, went under, collapsed. So we had FX margins with another investment bank, and at that point there was no confidence in the market whatsoever. So there was no tolerance for, okay, if you don't want to pay your FX margin call today, we'll extend it to tomorrow. It was like you pay today or you lose your hedge. And we had to liquidate 25% of the overall portfolio in US dollars to pay for our FX margin hedge. That was one of the most extreme moves in the Aussie dollar against the US dollar. It certainly, when we did all the testing of the structure, we didn't expect that large a move, but we got it, and we got a number of things which sort of exceeded any expectations or worst case scenarios. And we dealt with it by selling down the securities and funding that requirement. Our counterparty just wouldn't have accepted it any other way. There is one thing that I would like to note, and that is having the bank, the National Australia Bank, also sitting behind Triple Point was useful last year because they were able to provide emergency credit lines if we needed them, but we didn't need them because the portfolio is liquid. And we monitor the liquidity of the portfolio on a day-to-day basis, and we could liquidate 80% of the portfolio in any given day and the remaining 20% within a matter of weeks. So,
any more questions?
Hello, Lorraine.
Thanks, Christina. Michael, David mentioned the sort of the back to basics mentality, and when you were introducing hedge funds, you used three words that a lot of investors find scary now, which are shorting, derivatives and leverage. You've obviously overcome that in the institutional space. You're getting good flows. So how have you addressed that with, I guess, super fund trustees to give some ideas of how advisors can address that with their clients?
So people are concerned about it because shorting is bad for the markets, or... Right.
So the era of back to basics, how do you overcome the perception that leverage is not good, you know, derivatives are scary, shorting is scary?
Let me tackle leverage first, because I think that's a really interesting point. Investors typically think of equities as being the thing in the portfolio which will, yes, it comes along with greater volatility, but it's what you have in the portfolio to enhance your returns. Without them, you won't be able to target inflation plus 3-4%. But what people fail to recognise is what you're actually doing when you invest in an equity is you're actually buying a company which is geared. You're buying a company which is gearing its earning streams. And what they do is they wrap it up in a limited liability vehicle. And so people are quite comfortable with the implicit gearing of buying equities. In fact, 70% of portfolios are invested in companies that are geared. And hedge funds, what they do is they take that gearing to a different level. So rather than being at the company level, they'll actually take it out and put it at the fund level. So it's important to make sure that that fund is also a limited liability so that you don't get caught out by the manager being over-geared and then having a claim on your other assets. And so by going long and short a company, or two different companies, you're essentially neutralising the gearing at the company level and you're taking it to the top level. And then what you're doing is actually profiting from the the movements in each of the stock prices. So to me, the concepts of short selling and derivatives and gearing are not scary concepts, but they have to be well managed. And I think really in this environment, it's important to look at your expanded toolkit and say, well, what's available to me and how can I make money in this market if I'm not going to make it out of, if I'm not going to meet my retirement targets by being 100% invested in equities.
Just wondering if you've got a asset allocation, 20%, international shares, 30%, Australian shares, et cetera, where would the hedge fund sit and how much would you want to be allocating to a balanced portfolio, for example?
Yeah, it's an interesting question because you're trying to take a square peg and put it into a round hole. In some senses, the diversified portfolio of hedge funds that I've talked about have overlapping risks with a balanced fund. A balanced fund has equity risk, it has credit risk, and so do hedge funds. So where does it fit? Well, we've told our clients that you should think about it in terms of if it's a 70-30 growth defensive mix, then you should allocate from 70% equities or growth and from 30% bonds and cash. And together, you're investing in this diversified portfolio of hedge funds. And what you should be aiming to do is have that portfolio of hedge funds outperform your balance fund, be accretive to returns over time. Now, what allocation is a very, tricky question. Our clients in the superannuation space are between 5 and 15%, depending on the individual objectives for trustees. And I'd say that that would be about the same for the retail market as well. Personally, over time, I think that these techniques will be more widely adopted and that, provided those issues are resolved, that allocations will increase to the space. And you laugh, Peter, and I don't understand why.
Yeah, because it's a question we get all the time. And one of the things one of our pet hates, to be honest, is anything that's non-mainstream is just lumped in this alternatives category. And a lot of people say, well, how much exposure should I have to alternatives? And, there's this, 10%. And then when you're trying to allocate between sort of fund-to-fund hedge funds, commodities, agribusiness, the list goes on. You don't get a meaningful allocation to any of them. So with a lot of the products as much as possible, and this is what a lot of people get mixed up with, they are actually alternative strategies. So like a long-short, to put it in basic terms, a long-short equity fund. In Australian equities, we would have in the Aussie equities asset class. Having said all of that, fund-to-fund hedge funds, because they invest in multiple asset classes, multiple managers, multiple regions, multiple markets, they really are probably in that alternatives asset class. But I agree with Michael in that. And for that reason, I think when you're allocating, let's say, in a balanced fund up to 10%, where does that 10% come from? It actually comes from all of the other asset classes because they do actually have pretty defensive qualities. Hedge fund of funds, so and relatively low volatility, so sort of it's a proportional reduction in the rest of the asset classes.
We have room for one more question before we have to wind up.
If you just take the say what Bill Gross was saying, Michael, basically normalisation of returns, or certainly the level of return profile that we've seen out of markets. Through 03 to 07 is not likely to be repeated going forward. So the normalisation, in the sense that everyone says about hedge funds, is going to be give you cash plus 5%. And on the basis that you're investing in strategies that obviously companies that are part of the broader macro environment, therefore is it a truism that you're going to be able to maintain a 5% plus cash return out of these strategies going forward?
Yeah, I think the opportunities today presented to hedge funds in particular will mean that they'll exceed their cash plus 5% objectives for a period of time before they normalise. So they're in a different cycle to the market cycle. And it won't be reliant or dependent on equity markets per se, but it will be dependent on how individual stocks behave within that market, and it's going to be a function of liquidity which is already being restored into the markets and level of confidence in the markets. Provided those prerequisites are met, then hedge fund returns are going to be quite strong. Not in every manager, but in diversified portfolios, I think they'll do quite well. And whereas 2 years ago, there was no liquidity premium being offered in the market, if you do have cash and you are prepared to lock it up, there is a liquidity premium being paid. And there are opportunities in distressed securities where there's restructuring of companies, and that will last for quite some time as well.
I've just heard the bell. Before I thank our speakers, could I ask you to please take out your rating card and spend 20 or 30 seconds rating this presentation and placing any comments or questions onto your rating card. I'd like to thank our speakers. Thank you. Michael, Peter and David. And if you could all join me in thanking the speakers and then move to your next session. Thank you.